Hello, I'm here to tell you about Probably True, a slightly filthy podcast talking about queer life and even queerer sex, with plenty of knob jokes thrown in just for fun. It's called Probably True, but it's all real. My mum listens and she doesn't need to know about the time I ended up covered. Actually, never mind. If you want to find out what happened, you'll have to download it. Just search for Probably True wherever you get your podcasts and you can find out all the silly, sexy, funny, filthy details.
Welcome to The Astroholic Explains,
a podcast where we try to explain the universe's greatest mysteries with fictional stories, Q&As, and interviews.
Join Dr. Alfredo Carpinetti, the self-styled astroholic,
and Chris, my partner in life and in science.
Featuring experts and brilliant voice actors, join us in a light-hearted journey of discovery. Welcome to a brand new episode of The Astroholic Explains. Today we have a pretty cool episode, and we have an extra special guest. Extra special guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joby Rozelle Hollis.
Hi, Joby.
Hey, Joby. Please tell us a little bit about what you do.
Okay, so I'm a NASA postdoctoral fellow at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, and I'm on the science team for the Mars 2020 mission, which will be landing on Mars in early 2021.
That's very exciting.
That's super exciting. So, one big question I'm going to ask you to kick this whole thing off today. Is there life on Mars?
Yeah, you need to take it because I'm going with a very much David Bowie approach to this.
I was expecting you to sing that.
Yeah.
Spiders on Mars?
Well, spiders on Mars, lichens on Mars, there's everything on Mars.
Short answer is we don't know yet.
What's the long answer?
The long answer is that Mars is actually a far more inhospitable place than we believed, say, 100 years ago. Certainly when we first started turning telescopes towards Mars and we saw, for example, Valles Marineris, the massive canyons on the surface of Mars, the original early astronomers believed that they were canals and that the system, the planet had been irrigated by some kind of like sentient life form. That's where the whole like, you know, War of the World style aliens, Martians, that's where that concept began.
Wow.
But obviously, since we've actually visited Mars with robotic spacecraft and landers, one of the things we've discovered is that Mars is a very, very unpleasant place now. imagine the most inhospitable part of Earth. And it will still be so much nicer than the nicest part of Mars. Basically because at least you can still breathe the air on Earth.
Yeah.
On Mars, there's very little atmosphere. There's a lot of radiation. There's very little water that we can find. And when there is water, it is generally tied up in ice deep underground. We've explored Mars far more than we've ever explored any other world beyond Earth. But unfortunately, what that means is that we have sent a couple of satellite missions, so satellites orbiting the red planet, as well as 8 or 9 landers. And those landers have sampled specific locations on the surface, and we have not found conclusive evidence either way that there are living things present there now.
Okay, that's...
I just wanted to add that you can sort of blame the Italian for the misconception about Mars, because astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli is the one that first saw Valles Marineris, and he called it in Italian the canale, but in Italian it means both channel and canal. So when it was translated, we sort of pretty much brought forward the idea that there were little green men.
Well, I think the idea of life on what appeared to be Earth's sister world was very appealing to start with. I don't think they needed much incentive to to conclude that there must be aliens because there were lines on a planet.
To be honest, you're right. There was also something similar when first exploration of Venus came up because there were so many clouds and we couldn't see the surface. It was so excitement of what kind of people could live there. And, well, things Mars is inhospitable. Venus is a hellscape.
Well, the current understanding of Martian history is that for about a billion years or so, early Earth and early Mars were very similar worlds. They were hot and wet. They both had magnetic fields, and it was around the same time that life evolved on Earth. Like the most simple, like microbial single cell life evolved about 3.5 billion years ago. And we believe that it's possible that the conditions on Mars were similar enough that that could have happened there. So we don't think we can't discount the possibility that there was life. However, we have not yet found evidence, chemical or physical evidence, that there was that life on the surface that we've explored so far. But if you imagine, like, if you were to sample 8 random locations on Earth, you probably wouldn't be able to infer the existence of human beings. So, that's, you know, fair. It's worth understanding that's a very small sample size when you spread it across a whole world. Yeah. Now, the really big challenge with Mars is that, yeah, if early Earth and early Mars were very similar, well, how did they diverge? And so Earth, as we know it today, it was hot and wet back then, and it's still pretty warm and wet now. We have a lot of liquid water on the surface of the Earth. We still have a good thick atmosphere full of moisture, and we have a magnetic field. So the planet's still warm and wet, really. And that's what, as far as we know, that's what life likes. The problem is that as Mars is a lot smaller than Earth, so Mars cooled down a lot faster than Earth did. And as it cooled down, the magnetic field shut down because the molten metal core of the planet solidified. So you no longer have that dynamo effect that creates a magnetic field that shields the planet from radiation. And without that shield, the atmosphere started getting stripped away by the solar wind. So as the atmosphere faded away over the next billion years or so, the planet got colder and colder and colder, and then all the liquid water froze and ended up deep underground. So right now, the current surface of Mars, even though we can see evidence of these channels like Valles Marineris, we can see what were ancient riverbeds and deltas. So we know that liquid water once flowed on the surface of Mars, but now it's more arid than the deserts you find on Earth.
Wow.
I'm really feeling that it's time for an intervention on Mars. I'm like, when did it all went wrong? You were doing so well. What happened?
In terms of the ice that's deep underground now on Mars, I know that there's is it a little mole robot that's digging on Mars?
You're referring to the mole on InSight.
Yes.
Yeah. So
it's not digging for ice.
It's not digging for ice. No. So currently, seismology.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's a thermal probe. Yeah. So it's studying the temperature changes as you go deeper into the. So one of the interesting things is even though we've sent multiple missions that successfully landed on the surface of Mars, we've never actually explored more than a few centimeters into the Mars's surface.
Wow.
And it's partly because it's very difficult sending a big drill to another planet and expecting it to work. So the mole was one of the instruments that was put aboard the NASA InSight lander that landed earlier in 2019. And unfortunately, they hit a snag very, very early on. They managed to drill down a few centimeters before they suspect it hit a stone or something, and it lost traction. Yeah. And it's quite remarkable the effort has been made to try to they pulled the probe out and they've tried to, it was originally designed to only go down once and not come back up. But, you know, NASA engineers are determined, if anything else, and they've been trying to find ways to get the mole to regain traction and start digging again, mostly by, holding the lander's scoop against the side of the mole to give it something to purchase on so they can dig back down into the sand.
Oh, yeah, you can check out the video online. There are quite cute in a way that we have to come up with creative solutions. Modern problems require ancient solution. They're literally holding it down so it can dig. And it's all about not knowing exactly what they were going to find. And it's both fascinating, but also really a testament for the engineers at NASA and I think a co-project with the DLR in Germany.
I'm afraid I don't know.
But yeah, it's brilliant. It's just people finding new solution.
I'm not mistaken, am I, that the InSight has recorded the sound of Mars quakes?
It has, yeah. So one of the other instruments aboard InSight is a seismograph that has detected the first Mars quakes, which is incredible because this is a planet that, as far as we know, is tectonically inactive. So it doesn't have plates anymore, partly because the planet's too cold. You know, you need a thin crust and a hot mantle to drive plate tectonics. Mars has not had that in billions of years. However, there is still enough strain being put on the rock on the surface of Mars to create Mars quakes that we can detect. And that's incredibly exciting because we can infer a lot about the structure of the planet, like the interior structure, from the from things like how these seismic waves propagate.
In late December, they announced that they actually been able to follow a couple of the biggest earthquakes, well, not earthquakes, Marsquakes, all the way to their origin point. And they hope to now combine that with satellite observation and see if there are changes on the surface, like a boulder rolling and maybe a landslide. And it's super exciting.
So they're literally analyzing it from underground and from space.
Not sort of underground, because it records something that happened on the ground.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's very exciting.
Ooh. Earlier you mentioned as well that there was about 7 or 8 landers, rovers on Mars? Or the amount
I can't remember the exact number, but it's around 8 or 9 have successfully landed over the last 40 to 50 years.
I see, I had no idea they went back that far. That we've been landing
things on Mars. The first successful landers on Mars were the Viking probes that landed in the 70s. And they were the first experiments we ever did on another planet, at least another planet's surface. And we're still actually analyzing and reinterpreting data that they collected in the context of the measurements we've done more recently.
Oh, that's clever.
So there's a great example of that. The Viking landers in the 70s had these biological experiments on board that were designed to detect organic compounds. They were the very first attempt to see if we could find the chemical signs of life on Mars. And unfortunately, the results were inconclusive, partly because one of the things they found was that all the compounds were chlorinated, and they didn't understand it at the time, and they just concluded it was a contamination from within the instrument itself. However, the Phoenix lander and the Curiosity rover have since discovered the origin of that chlorination. So the current understanding is that the instruments that they were using used a technique called pyrolysis. So in order to extract the organic material from the soil, and in this case, organic, just, it doesn't mean like organic as in like, you know, pesticide free kind of biological material, like, you know, apples or potatoes. What we mean is, in a chemical context, it's anything that's got a backbone of carbon atoms and contains potentially hydrogen and oxygen, nitrogen. These are like the elemental building blocks of life as we know it. So they used a technique called pyrolysis to extract the organic material from the soil. And that basically is, you heat up the soil and you detect the fragments of molecules as they come off that hot rock. But unfortunately, a lot of Martian soil contains a chemical compound called perchlorate. This is a chlorine oxygen molecule that breaks down at high temperatures and releases chlorine atoms that will then attack and damage organic molecules nearby. So unfortunately, if you try to extract organic material in the present, but using heat in the presence of perchlorate, you end up with a lot of chlorinated compounds that may not have been chlorinated in the first place. So that's made it much more difficult for our interpretation. But it does mean that we can go back to those Viking measurements done in the 70s and go, oh, that's why they were chlorinated. That, you know, so we can still reinterpret those results based on the context that we have now.
That is fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. I didn't know that.
Well, there's still some disagreement about exactly whether the extent of chlorination that was present before pyrolysis. But unfortunately, the issue here is that we cannot confirm or deny what that was, because it's been obscured by the subsequent chlorination during pyrolysis.
Would the pyrolysis like pre-Viking landers, rovers?
They were landers, yes.
Pre-Viking landers. Would that have had a big effect on why Mars is currently so arid? Would that process have actually contributed towards destroying potential biological life on Mars and breaking it down? Is that why it's...
Well, partly that, yes. I mean, certainly perchlorate is toxic to terrestrial life here on Earth. And you wouldn't want to be growing vegetables in soil that contained 1% by weight perchlorate, trust me. So we know it's certainly not amenable to life, but in this case, it was the combination of heat and perchlorate that was so damaging. We have to recognize, though, that without a thick atmosphere, without an ozone layer, and without a magnetic field, Mars is a very irradiated environment. There's a lot of harsh ultraviolet from the sun, solar wind, cosmic rays. The surface is a fairly unpleasant place, and a lot of that radiation will damage organic material like DNA, break it down.
Yeah.
It will be basically the worst sunburn you could imagine. So certainly right now, as it stands, you wouldn't want to be on the surface of Mars without a good spacesuit. Mm. Not just because of the cold, not just because of the weak atmosphere, but also because of the radiation. And that radiation will be a hazard to any living thing on the surface. Unfortunately, some experiments have shown that if you treat a fairly radiation-resistant bacterium, such as cyanobacteria, to Martian levels of ultraviolet, you can sterilize it within about half an hour. So you can render cyanobacteria, which are like the kind of basic bacteria that absorb sunlight and turn it into chemical energy, you can kill them all within an hour or so. So it's a pretty unpleasant environment, which is why a lot of the questions about potential life on Mars, whether it is present now or if it existed in the past, we are looking more and more at the subsurface, because ultraviolet light doesn't penetrate very far, maybe a couple of millimeters to a half a centimeter into most rock. So if you can get deep enough below the surface, you'll be protected from that radiation. Mm. And what's more, the deeper into the ground you go, the warmer it gets. There's no possibility of liquid water on the surface of Mars under the current conditions that we can observe. But, and while there may have been liquid water in the past, it's possible that there is still liquid water on Mars, but it's simply hundreds of meters below the surface where the pressure creates a higher temperature. So there could be a habitable region on Mars that is nothing to do with where you are with respect to the equator, but could be dependent on how deep into the planet you go.
Hmm.
One of the mission goals of the MOLE instrument on InSight was to establish the thermal gradients that you observe as you go below the surface. And of course, if the radiation dose you get goes down, you might find that habitable zone where it's warm enough for liquid water and the radiation levels are low enough that some molecules could have organized together to form a self-replicating organism.
Wow.
I'm now picturing a sort of underground water park for Martians.
Hollow Mars theory.
The whole Mars theory, I like it.
I feel like I should nib that in the bud before we get any further.
So, since we've been talking about the exploration, you want to tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm on the science team for Mars 2020, but more specifically, I work on one instrument that's going aboard the Mars 2020 rover. The instrument is called Sherlock, and like everything at NASA, it is an acronym. It stands for Scanning Habitable Environments Using Raman and Luminescence of Organics and Chemicals.
Love so it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And even better...
It is one of my favorite acronyms. Like, for me, the top is still Boomerang, which is a mission to study the cosmic microwave background, and cannot remember the acronym, but it was a mission that would circle the Antarctic winds and come back to the same place, so that was... genius, but I love Sherlock. Very good.
It's even better than you think. So the Sherlock instrument is attached to a wide field camera called Watson.
Yes! Oh, I love it.
So yes, Sherlock and Watson are built together. They are mounted onto the end of the arm of the rover. So it's designed to, whenever the rover finds a rock or a surface of interest, so we think there's some particularly interesting mineral strata there, or we think we may have found, for example, clay that could contain organic material because it came from an ancient riverbed. What we can do is we extend the rover's arm to hold the Sherlock and Watson instruments over the surface in question, and we can take a picture with Watson, and then we scan the surface with Sherlock. So Sherlock uses an ultraviolet laser, scans it across the sample. We look at the light that gets scattered back. Some of that light will be what's called fluorescent, so that's light that's been absorbed by molecules in the rock, and then those molecules have released that light at different wavelength. And for example, biological molecules like DNA, protein, these all have very distinctive fluorescence features that we will be able to identify. What's more, we also get this thing called Raman scattering, which is basically like a fingerprint of a molecule. What happens is when the light bounces off these molecules, there's a chance you can excite what they call atomic vibrations. So you imagine the actual molecular structure is starting to vibrate in a certain way, and that creates a very distinctive pattern of peaks that we observe. And basically, it's so specific to that molecule structure that it's effectively a fingerprint. So we are able to use this instrument to non-destructively scan a surface looking for complicated organic molecules that could be the building blocks of life. And we'll be able to not just detect them, but also identify them and build up a picture of what minerals they're associated with and how they could have been deposited and when. And the whole idea is we're looking for the building blocks of life. So, for example, life as we know it on Earth has four bases of DNA. Mm-hmm. And roughly 22 amino acids that make up protein. You know, in the most simple terms, those are the building blocks of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't know what the building blocks of life would be on another planet. It could be a completely different set of molecules. But life as we understand it operates on certain principles. For example, it uses complex molecules to create certain and control chemical reactions. We have enzymes made of protein that regulate chemical reactions so that the body, so that the cell can produce energy from food and use it to build new molecules, new DNA, create new cells, or just engage in basic metabolism. And we believe that those general principles will apply to alien life as well. The big question for us really is, if we do find evidence of like even just a simple cell, is it made from the same building blocks as us, or is it made from a completely different set? That we may be made of 22 amino acids, but there are thousands of possible amino acids that can occur spontaneously. Which ones will have ended up being the building blocks of life? If they use the same building blocks as us, that could imply that we come from a similar origin. So life on Mars could have come from Earth or vice versa. And similarly, if they are made from a completely different set of building blocks, then that gives us a whole new insight into a different kind of biochemistry that we've never seen before. Whatever the answer is, it's going to be fascinating and will drive research for decades.
Oh my God, I am mind blown right now.
I was at a conference in 2019 about how often there's been contamination between Earth and Mars, because it's perfectly possible for rocks from either planet after a big impact to fly to the other planet and land without getting too hot or be too destroyed. So life could survive.
And I'll just say that's not a hypothetical. We have looked at Martian meteorites that we've found in Antarctica. So these are rocks that were knocked off Mars in an impact hundreds of millions of years ago. We found intact amino acids in those. As far as we can tell, they just occurred through simple, like spontaneous geochemistry. So that what we would call abiotic signatures rather than biological signatures. But we have found these basic building blocks in Martian meteorites. The big question is, can we find anything more complicated, like strings of amino acids all hooked together into something that could potentially be a protein?
So that would be like exciting.
So the amino acids that were found on these little pieces of rock in Antarctica, they are something that could imply building blocks of life, but they don't necessarily imply the actual building blocks of life.
Well,
they could be something else.
One issue we have is that even in Antarctica, that's not a sterile environment. Mm. If those meteorites have been in Antarctica for any length of time, we cannot discount the possibility that they may be contaminated by terrestrial life post-impact.
Yeah.
So that's the big question, is we really need to be able to detect these molecules in situ, as in like on the surface of Mars, to be absolutely sure that...
Yep, that makes sense.
That's where they came from.
Right. I think we answered the question, is there life on Mars, the only way we can, by saying that we have no clue. It's a solid maybe, and we're trying our best. Well, we're not trying, but people like Joby are trying their very best to find it.
I do enjoy the fact that I can legitimately talk about extraterrestrial life, even if there's a question mark at the end. I actually have used the phrase extraterrestrial life ? In a paper that I have published. I really enjoy that.
That is so quite
exciting.
An accomplishment.
It's so exciting. This has been like such an amazing episode. I've learned so much, and quite a lot of the answers have blown my mind.
Likewise.
Yeah, we may not have a conclusive answer to the question of whether there is life on Mars, but even the information we've already found out has taught us so much about where we may have come from and the possibilities of just, you know, basically just trying to think about what could have happened on another world really extends the horizons of what we understand. So I like to think that there is no bad answer to the question of is there life on Mars? Because whatever we discover, we're learning something really profound and really important that helps us find our own position in the universe.
What a note to end on.
Yeah, can I say it better myself?
Thank you so much for being our special guest today.
Yes, yeah, thank you, Joby. Fantastic.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you very much.
And this is it for another episode of The Astroholic Explains.
Follow us on social media at The Astroholic and feel free to send in more questions.